Well, here it is, a minute and a half past 1 o'clock, and it's time for us now to welcome to our WAVN microphones an old friend of ours, because this guy we're going to introduce, ladies and gentlemen, was on WAVN radio quite a few years ago with his own program, and we welcome Cal Restrum back. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Ed. I noticed we have a natural-born skeptic here. When the weather report came through with the clear skies, he looks out the window to see what...
Well, it's a little crazy if there are a few clouds around. The announcer says, you know, that we have clear skies. But we do. We have absolutely beautiful weather.
Ed, I got a different idea in mind this time. Instead of running this through on a lot of questions, why don't we kind of follow the book through and note the chapters and see if we can come up with a kind of a book review this time, okay?
Very good. Now, first of all, to our listeners, Cal has been with us several different times talking about his writings, and what book number is this now?
This is number 10 that's already published. It came out the 23rd of September.
You have published 10 books.
10 books on the wilderness.
All of them on wilderness, outdoor living, and you certainly have experienced each and every one of those books, haven't
that's
you?
That's correct. They seem to think I have, anyway.
I know you have. Cal is, I don't know, are you native of this, of the valley here, Cal?
Yes, I am. I'm a Marine on St. Croix citizen since about 1934.
And when did you start your writing? When did you decide you wanted to be an author?
I think I must have fallen out of the cradle and scratched some hieroglyphics on the floor.
Well, you have written some wonderful books. And what's the title of this latest one now, number 10?
This one is The Wilderness Life. And this is probably somewhat different from all the rest of the books in that it's a wilderness philosophy. I'm going to just read one paragraph here, if you don't mind. Most of us have come to discover that wilderness is not some alien interest that we might capriciously regard or disregard. It impinges heavily upon every one of us, since it is so essential and integral to our whole way of life. Even those who existentially hope to adhere strictly to urban life might find in these pages how they also inescapably fit into the complex scheme of the Earth's natural environment. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we used to think of the outdoors as some place to go and hunt and fish and recreate generally. But the whole world now has gotten involved in the outdoors because we have at last discovered that the only way we're going to survive is to try to preserve this wilderness of ours. Now, I don't want to get out on a ecological bent here and just try to talk about pollution and so forth. But what I'd like to talk about is that we are, in the city, as well as in the country and in the wilderness, inescapably a part of the wilderness. This is the thing that seems to be becoming pretty well known. People are becoming pretty aware of this idea generally now. This is Tuesday, say Sunday, I saw something, and so did you, I'm sure that everybody else did, that was more extraordinary than usual. We had car jams, traffic jams, over the entire northern part of the United States in Canada. For one thing, what, to go and see a queen? To see some big event? No, to see the leaves coloring.
Leaves.
And this is the thing. I think people are building up an awareness of the outdoors where they really think that it's a part of their lives. And I think that this chapter this paragraph that I just read kind of substantiates that.
No, just reading this past week, there's really only so much of it, and we do have to take care of it. I was reading something about our oil supplies will only take us to the year 2000, and that's all over the world. That's frightening to me. So we have to take care of these things, don't we?
Well, governor of California, Brown, was on television here just a few days ago, and frankly, I don't want to criticize our own politicians. Some of them are doing exceptionally well. But he was the first man that I have heard for years that came out with an intellectual approach rather than a political approach to this whole subject. He says we've got to get along with a little less, each one of us, so that everybody will have something.
That's right.
And the idea is that if we don't do that, we're going to find ourselves behind the eight ball. There's no question about it.
Well, Cal, on with the book. The book is entitled The Wilderness Life. In chapter one, with the wilderness point of view, can you tell me something about this?
Well, the wilderness point of view is changing. And I think I could even stick my neck out far enough to say that it's changing drastically in the last few years. We get an idea when we see people moving into the suburbs, into the outer suburban area, and into the wilderness, setting up residence and so forth. They are not taking the idea that this is just some place to go, but this is some place where they can have an attitude toward their whole life. The wilderness is not an entity within itself. It is a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Thoreau said, wildness is a preservation of the world. Now, people don't understand this now, but they will in time.
Mm-hmm. And on with the next chapter, we come to what to expect.
Well, most people, of course, entering into the wilderness, they expect something entirely different from what they anticipated as a rule. We have seen people coming down this St. Croix, you know, going out on a Saturday and staying over the weekend, and the sun is shining, everything is beautiful, and when they get up there, starts to cloud up, and starts to rain, and starts to get rough, and so forth, and they can't cope with this thing. And so, the same way in the wilderness, they're usually taking 2 weeks of a vacation each year, and in that period of time, they try to encompass their entire wilderness interest. This isn't possible. What they have to do is to move into the wilderness with the expectation of meeting responsibilities and obligations just as they do in the city. And I think that they're doing it. I think they're mm-hmm. gradually doing it.
Okay, so in this chapter, what to expect, you talk about the various things that you can expect. Do you give any answers as to
yes,
how to cope with
yes,
them?
We do. I said something about that this book can be a happy book. I think it becomes evident from reader reaction to Once Upon a Wilderness, that was a former book,
mm-hmm.
that a somewhat philosophic and critical view of wilderness or wildness as a basic concept might make no less a happy book, and one that could include as well various human interest narratives of experience in nature. And I have always tried to resolve the problems I take into consideration. And if you don't do that, you might just well not utter them, because people are looking for some kind of solution. They're not looking for critical attitudes where they're not defined.
Very good. I agree with you, because we do have enough things to think about, and now we have the answers. You give us something to think about, and you give us the answer.
Well, that's presuming a little bit too much that you have the answer, the full answer. But you try to give your own experience as possibly something that they can equate with. And if they can equate with even a small part of what your own experience has been, then they can go from there, I think.
Now, it seems to me that at one time, did you not take a dog team and all the books that you could get on the sled, and you went way back and you stayed a winter in the, I don't know exactly how far north you were, but it seems to me in our conversations you talked about that. And now we come to chapter 3, Man Against the Wilderness. And if there's one person I know that can talk about that, that's you.
Perhaps I should just mention that, without getting boastful, that for the last 55 or 60 years, I have traveled in the wilderness by canoe. When I say the wilderness, I'm speaking of Canada, largely, by canoe and dog sled and on foot. And the thing is that you really get to understand what you're up against, as this chapter says, Man Against the Wilderness. And I think that the reader will see in this chapter what he might possibly anticipate and what he actually will see when he gets into the wilderness. I think that that's a good introduction to this book.
I would think so, too. But then as we go along in our review today of Cal's latest writings, we come to chapter 4, As a Way of Life.
Well, we have, pardon me for saying so, but we are basically mammal.
We're
human animals. And so we go into the city and we think that from the asphalt and from the elevators and from the mechanization and so forth, that we are an integral part of that whole civilization. Actually, we're a part of the whole natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we should change our attitude a little bit. Not, I think of the circus horse, you know, going down the highway, or rather in the city street on a parade. He's got it all. He's got a hat on there that he doesn't care for, and his feet are banging up against the paving. It might reminds you of that old saying, the Englishman, it ain't the heavy alling that hurts the horses, it's the emma of the oofs on the odd highway. And I think I like to compare that with the horse that's racing with his remuda up through a canyon, you know, practically flying because he has that agility and so forth. That's the life. Now, we aren't going to live that way, but it seems to me we can assume a way of life that's a little bit more natural, a little bit less artificial, and as we have seen, that even in New York today, it's growing into an absolutely inviable state. They don't know what to do with the thing, financially and otherwise. And if our cities are going to become cancers, maybe the outdoors is the attitude that people should take as a part of their life. Not even have to exclusively go out and live in the wilderness, but they can go out and consider it as a way of life. I think instead of the way of life, food, clothing, and shelter, and elevators, and asphalt, and so forth, they can have a few trees in there. It seems that most of the people get in the city is probably a plant from the florist shop. They're still looking for the little touch of nature, mm-hmm. but they need a little bit more of it. Need a little bit more of it as a way of life. And I think aesthetically and biologically and every other way, they'll benefit by it.
No, when you're talking, I'm thinking about Mother Nature and nature itself, and it seems to me that nature is one of the very few things that actually has worked and will continue to work if we let it work.
Well, it's working all the time.
That's why we want a part of it, it seems, in our homes. We know it's going to work.
Yeah. I think that this getting out into the suburbs by a vast amount of our population is a recognition of just what you're saying.
We'll be back to continue our discussion with our guest today, Cal Rustrum. We're talking about Cal's latest book, The Wilderness Life. We have progressed to Chapter 4, and when we return, we're going to ask Cal about Chapter 5, which is Security in the Wilderness, so don't go away.
These days, you hear a lot of suggestions for saving energy. One of the very best is to make sure your home has sufficient attic insulation. Why not check your attic today? If you don't have enough insulation, or if the insulation you have has settled so that ceiling joists are exposed, you're probably losing precious energy. You can solve this problem by adding more insulation yourself or call NSP. They'll give you details on their insulation financing program along with names of participating insulation contractors. NSP will finance that attic insulation job. That way you can pay the cost gradually over a period of months. The payments are simply added to your monthly NSP bill. Insulation financing is available to all NSP residential customer homeowners in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. If you have any questions about insulating your home or financing the job, call your local NSP office. Northern States Power Company wants to help.
Our guest today on Public Forum is Cal Rustrum. We have talked with Cal several times about his various books. This is number 10. We're giving a somewhat of a book report, and we do hope these books are now available. Is that right,
yes,
Cal?
Yes, they are. They're available in the bookstores, and those who don't want to spend the money, they're available in libraries now.
Very good. We're to Chapter 5, Security in the Wilderness.
That probably should be the feature article of the day. With this inflation and this absolutely incompatible thing of 8 million people being out of work, and yet you can't get anybody to even to cut your lawn if you feel so fit. I just don't understand the economy today, but I do understand the economy of the wilderness. I've lived in that wilderness a great deal. My wife and I spend about 6 months of the year in the wilderness. And one of the strange aspects of the thing, and not so strange either, is the fact that my hand is not in my pocket looking for my purse every 5 minutes the way it is in the city. And we live in Canada. We found the prices quite high up there in Canada. But still, in spite of this, it seems that we have a very economical approach to life. Of course, when we're at our places up there, we have no fuel to pay for. We just take the canoe and go out and load it up with wood for our fire, for our Franklin fireplace stoves.
You're talking about windfall and stuff, you know, that comes up on the shore?
There's a vast amount of, well, on the shore of Lake Superior, these pulp rafts have broken up over the years, mm-hmm. and there's wood floating all over Lake Superior, and they're kind of a hazard once in a while. But they come into our shore in beautiful 8-foot golden looking logs, you know, and we just take a picaroon, an instrument for pulling them out of the water, take them up on the shore and dry them out. We have more fuel than we could possibly use. And here, yet they're talking about a fuel shortage. We have no fuel shortage up there.
Well, here's your security you're talking about, right?
That's right. And water. We have an unlimited amount of water, and we're not paying for water. And we can go down through the whole category. My wife went out and picked rose hips and dried them and made tea up there. And I see that this is getting to be quite a desirable product now. And even Germany is importing a great deal of rose hips here to the United States for making tea and for other things. And it seems that when we check our whole economy from week to week, we're spending a comparatively small amount of money, and we hear people complaining about the high cost of things. It reminds me of a fellow I ran into, a trapper I ran into many years ago. He had a little clearing in the wilderness, and had a little cabin there with the pipe sticking out of the window instead of coming out of the top. And he had a little garden there, and I said, it was during the period of the Depression, around the 30s, and I said, well, what do you think of the Depression? He turned around and looked up at me, he says, what Depression?
And was he serious?
Yes, he was. He was definitely serious, because he was a man who had no radio, he had no outside contact with the world, and yet he was getting along beautifully without worrying about his economy. And now we spend a considerable amount of money in the wilderness too, of course. And we have to have the provisions. We have to go to the cities and the nearest posts and places to buy this food. But the point of it is, when we're here at Marine, where we're living close to supermarkets, and we're paying for this and that and the other thing, the whole thing changes. And I think people might consider moving away a little bit from the place where somebody's reaching into your pocket every time you turn around.
That would be refreshing, wouldn't it? And it's available too, isn't it?
It is, definitely.
Well, we have Chapter 6 listing the early trip. The early trip.
Well, this book is trying to build in a little philosophy into the wilderness life so that you can probably know what you to experience and what to contend with when you get into the wilderness. Now, this early trip is actually a narrative of a canoe trip that I took in the early days when I tried to find a white partner to go on this trip. Well, people were too busy making the old buck to be able to get away for 7 weeks is the average trip that I made. So I went into the North Country alone, thinking that I'd have to make the trip alone. What happened was that I got into an area up there where the Winnipeg River flowed past the railroad, and there was a little bit of a post there where I got off the train. And there were about 18 Indians camped on an island. And they looked at my canoe, which was a birch bark canoe, by the way. In fact, I think I had one of the early birch bark canoes on the river that might be considered a recent period. There were, of course, Indians on this river with birch bark canoes, but we had this birch bark canoe, and the Indians were quite fascinated by the fact that here's a white man coming up here with a birch bark canoe, when actually they were using commercial canoes themselves. So I paddled over into this island, and I was treated royally when I got over to that island. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try to ingratiate myself the best way I can. So I suggested that they come over to my camp. All the 18 of them would have a kind of a feast over there. And instead of them inviting me to their area where there was lots of room, they came over and even helped to clear an area so that they could...
You're kidding.
Yeah.
They came over to help you.
They came over to clear an area so they could come in. I was inviting them, and they weren't going to insult me by saying, well, you come over here instead, you see.
Cal, we're going to take another quick break and be right back.
So far this year, this area has experienced everything from blizzards to torrential rains to floods to extremely high winds and excessive heat. Certainly this year has been one of extreme weather, the kind of weather that makes providing you with electricity a real challenge. I'm Dave McElroy, Chief Executive Officer of Northern States Power Company. I'm proud of the job our people have done to restore service in about every kind of inclement weather. Our NSP system has withstood the extreme weather with minimum damage. Nevertheless, there were many thousands of customers who lost power, and to you, we at NSP wish to say thanks for your patience and understanding. Our crews have worked hard to restore service quickly, in weather that most of us would hesitate to go out in, thereby minimizing the duration of service interruptions. So to you, our customers, thank you for your patience, and to our NSP employees who work long hours in the bitter cold and the wind and rain, we thank you for your dedicated service.
We're talking with Cal Rutstrom, and it's in regard to Cal's latest book. We're talking about the early trip, and it says something to me that they would actually come to your camp and help you clear a spot, and yet they had an area where there was no clearing required, right?
Now, this was a courtesy that they were extending to me. And you talk about intuitiveness. I didn't ask them for somebody to go with me on this trip. They just presumed that maybe I could use somebody on this trip. So they sent along a fellow with me, and I couldn't afford to pay for guides at that time, even though you could get a guide for $1 a day, you know. The thing about it was that we talked about the trip, and I asked them a lot of questions about the trip and so forth and so on. But as I say, they're intuitively quite clever, and the chief came to me and he said, would you like to have one of our people go along with you on this trip? So I got along. I went with an Indian, and I got to learn right down in a fundamental and elementary stage how an Indian lived in the woods, you know. And you know that for the first 10 days of that trip, we scarcely took anything out of the provisions that we
no
had
point.
Bought. He wanted to live off the country, and I, but at first he was a little bit hesitant about doing what he wanted to do, you know, as an Indian, because I had invited him along on this trip in a roundabout sort of a way, and he felt that he should subscribe to everything that I wanted to. So one night I said to him, I said, I would like to learn a little bit more how the Indian lives. I said, would you start in tomorrow morning and give me instructions? I said, I'm not going to tell you anything that I'd like to do from now on, because you're going to have to tell me what to do. And he kind of liked this.
Yeah.
He was up before daylight the next morning. He had a fire going, and he was out there with a fish net, and he caught some fish at the foot of the falls. And he went through the whole routine just as though I were an apprentice. And, oh, I learned more in that 7 weeks from him than I learned from any other process.
Did you have to pay him anything?
I didn't pay him anything because I didn't have any money to pay him. But what I did was I gave him the birch bark canoe, my tent, my rifle, everything I possessed in connection with the wilderness when I came back. And he was absolutely...
I'll bet he was ecstatic.
Yes, he was. He was pleased with it.
Well, our time is moving along, and we're only to chapter 6. Here we are at chapter 7, In Search of Fulfillment.
Well, that's the thing today. I go along the highway now, and I see hundreds of young people with pack sacks. They're not traveling in the woods. They seem to be just carrying along with them their capabilities for living from day to day. Yesterday, we were up at my wife and I were up at St. Croix Falls, and there we saw a young lad on a bicycle. He had a camping outfit on his bicycle. He'd been out to Oregon trying to get work out there in his particular field, but he didn't have any success. And he was sitting in there at 12 o'clock eating some crackers. And that's the extent of his lunch. And so we supplied the means of eating a little bit better for the day. He was just so pleased that somebody would give him that much consideration. But the thing about it, this search of fulfillment, people nowadays are moving away from the industrial struggle more and more all the time. They're looking for some grain of fulfillment in life that isn't just based on the dollar. And even men in big corporations are beginning to slip away from I know executives that are just retired at 40, you know, and they wouldn't think of it before. But the young people are searching. Up in the North Shore, there's a place at Hovland where a number of the young people have formed a kind of a commune, in a roundabout sense of the term. And they have a garden, and they have whatever they need to get along with, and they work a little bit to fill in the antecedent blanks of the economy. There's a search. The antenna, to use a term figuratively, is sort of waving around in front, trying to find something that'll give a purpose and a meaning to life other than just making the buck. This idea of making only the dollar and coming out with a fine home, two cars, and a cocktail bar, and a couple of dogs, this doesn't appeal anymore. It appeals to some people, but to the imaginative, I think they want something more from life. And this chapter might be very, very interesting to people who are kind of looking for something a little bit different from the conventional approach.
I know of a young lad, a person just like you're talking about. He has a biology degree, and he's in the wilderness as much as possible. Never practiced what he had learned, teaching it, etc. But is out looking, and is in love with nature. That's about it.
I haven't heard for a long time until just recently young fellows who were willing to use the word love out in the open and say, I love nature, you know. And I had a fellow come and visit last Sunday, visit my wife and I from Wisconsin. He brought his pal along with him. And he wrote us a letter here about several months ago, and he said, thank you for being you. In other words, he was so pleased that somebody would really come out and say the things that he wanted to hear without a circumspect approach to the life, a conventional approach, and put it on the line, you know, say mm-hmm. it as it is, as the old reporter said. Sports reporter said.
On chapter 8, we find scrutinizing the inscrutable wilderness.
Well, this chapter deals with the inability of too many people to see the wilderness. Most canoe trips are rat races. They skim down through the middle of the lake, and they see how many miles they can cover in one day, and they're very proud of the fact that they can cover 20 to 25 miles a day or more. And I like to hark back to that old statement of the fellow who was invited to go to Europe. He was a man of not very great means, and he had a friend of his who was a very wealthy man, and this wealthy man said to him, I would like to take you with me to Europe, he said, and it won't cost you anything. And he said, I think you would get a great deal out of the trip. And he answered, he says, I surely would, he says, but I haven't explored my backyard yet. Mm-hmm. And this is a point of view that in the wilderness, people should travel slower, they should learn a little bit more about it, because most of what they expected to see is hidden behind something.
It's true.
It's too obscure. And this obscurity in the wilderness is something that people have to learn. I try to point out in this chapter what that obscurity is and how they might go about seeing things in the wilderness differently from what they had approached before.
No need to tell you about it, but is there anything more pleasant than on a day like we have going today than to go into the forest or back off the paths and just sit down?
Yeah.
And,
reflect,
and look at it?
Reflect and contemplate. That's one of the things they need to do.
Then nature starts coming out when you sit and take your time.
Two fellows were sitting up against a tree talking in the woods and one was remarking how wonderful the coloring was and how beautiful everything is, you know, and so forth. And the other one didn't hear him. And he says, we've been sitting here an hour. He says, I could have made $12, he says, in that hour. You see, this is the thing. You've lost the point of view of interest if you put a price on everything.
On Chapter 9, the wilderness art, campcraft, and science.
Well, people do set up what to do after they get there. It's quite a different approach coming up now. There are many people who are building cabins in the wilderness area or in the perimeter. I would put some emphasis on this perimeter. People should build their cabin on the perimeter of the wilderness rather than deep in the wilderness, because if they have habitually lived in the city most of their lives, they need the contacts that they have had, at least in a small part.
Mm-hmm.
But many people now are using the wilderness cabin for a studio. And they're not only using it for a studio, but they're beginning to discover that, for instance, in photography, that they can approach the wilderness from a standpoint of making a living with photography. There are various agencies in the country who will buy your pictures now, natural pictures, if you get into this subject deep enough so that you know how to get the unusual picture. For example, we never thought of using a flash gun in connection with the bright sunlight in taking a picture. Now, nearly every picture I take, in fact, the picture on the cover of this book, I'd like to have people note, is taken where the sun is in front of me instead of behind me.
You're kidding.
Yeah, we always used to think of taking the picture with the sun over your shoulder.
Right.
And if you're using a camera to take pictures out of doors or even portraits, never get the sun behind you, always in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then use a fill-in light with a flash. Now you notice on this picture, Ed, that the light is bouncing off of these rocks, mm-hmm. and they're bouncing off of me and so forth. So you get the old saying, the angle of incidence is equal to the angle of whatever it is, you know what I mean?
Actually, looking at you sitting up upon this rock, there's hardly a shadow around. In other words, the sun is on the front part, the flash brought out all the rest of it.
Well, there is a slight shadow.
There's a little one.
Yeah. But you see what I have done here? I filled in with a flash here.
Right, the rock.
So that they like. Now, the Kodachrome film, or the color film, does not pick up the thing the way you see it. It will not pick up those deep shadows the way you look into them and see detail. So you have to fill in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much, but just enough so that you see it the way the eye sees it.
That's a beautiful picture. That's on the North Shore, isn't it?
That's right in front of our place on the shore of Lake Superior. That's our shoreline.
It's useless for me to try to describe it, folks, because that's a beautiful part of the country, and I don't think words can do it justice, really.
Now, the scientist is going into the wilderness. So nearly everything that we do scientifically nowadays is beginning to emanate from the earth, and people are beginning to see that they can even establish the scientific institution in the wilderness. So now wilderness art and science is getting to be something that is projected into the wild areas instead of just being in some laboratory in the city. Now, campcraft, of course, is something you're going to do incidental to your wilderness art and to your science, and there's an endless field of interest in campcraft as well as the art and science element.
The Seasonal Wilderness is Chapter 10. What do you have here?
Well, I have divided this up into the four seasons: spring, summer, fall, and winter. My travels in the wilderness are such that we go every season of the year. We do it for various reasons. We want to learn something about the wilderness in all of these seasons, and we don't want to be just sunny day campers.
Mm-hmm.
We want to learn what there is to be said about it. And I think that whoever reads this seasonal wilderness will begin to discover at least that there are great advantages to be had in all of the seasons, whereas they ordinarily might just look for the 2 weeks in the warm summer. And here again, get back, Ed, to the point of how to cope with these various seasons. There are ways of coping with them, and this tells pretty much how we might cope with the various seasons.
By the way, who does all of your artwork, Cal? Do you sketch?
No, I don't sketch. The Les Kuba of Minneapolis
is your fellow, right?
Yeah, and he has an art gallery over there, a wildlife gallery, and he has been making my black and white illustrations for most of my books. One or two I have done by photography, but even in some of the books that he has illustrated, a photograph sometimes will do better than a drawing, and in reverse to that, the drawing might be better than the photograph. So I work with him and use photographs to a certain extent, and then does the main part.
You've touched on the Indian and his way of life. What do you have in Chapter 11? It's titled The Wilderness Indian.
Well, when I went on a trip up into the Hudson's Bay region, I stopped at Churchill, and the Canadian Broadcasting Company found out that I was headed up that way. So they sent along a team to interview me at Churchill. And we went to the newspaper office there to do the interviewing. And the first question they asked me was, what should we do with the Indian and the Eskimo? And this riled me a little bit. How should we just manipulate
What
should we do with them? I said, before I answer that question, may I preface the answer with a question? What should the Indian and the Eskimo do with the white man? I said, it seems to me more applicable. You know what happened?
No.
They cut off the interview.
They didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't give them the answer. They were, whoa.
They were looking for some kind of a conventional answer where we could just push the Indian and the Eskimo around to suit our particular caprices, you know, and this riled me. And I guess they noted in the first answer that I had given that they weren't going to get the answers that the public wanted to hear.
Well, I agree with your answer right today. We're running up on our time, so maybe we could get over to Chapter 12. The wilderness, what do we have, the wilderness guile?
Wilderness guile, yeah. This is a strange chapter in that it shows that most people who are going into the wilderness and they get rather excited about it and interested in it, they presume that in a couple of weeks a year they can learn all there is to be learned about it. And as I've often said, you can criticize a man's politics and his religion and even his wife, but if you criticize his capability of living in the wilderness, why, you're touching on a pretty tender chord. And so this chapter has several narratives in there on what happens to the fellow who thinks he knows it all and can't learn something about the wilderness. I was up here at St. Croix Falls just on a hike one day, and there was a fellow splitting wood. And every time he drove his axe into this block of wood, he'd get stuck, and he'd fight with it. And I said, I'll show you a little trick, I said, to avoid that. And he says, why don't you mind your own damn business? And I said, that's a good idea, I says, when I'm talking to somebody that doesn't seem to be able to learn. The idea was that there was a certain trick about twisting the axe, so you split out the piece without the axe sticking. And so there are things to be learned about the whole process of living in the wilderness that people think they know, and they don't know them. And I'm still learning. I'll have my 80th year 26th of October, and I'm still learning. I'm even learning things from Boy Scouts and from people who are in love with the wilderness and I'm getting little ideas here and there. And I add to my, just the other day, I learned something about what they call a trucker's hitch. I've never heard of it in my life. You mix a block and tackle out of a rope alone.
Just the rope.
Just the rope.
There's a saying that I'm trying to remember, and I know I can't remember all of it, but the greatest thought hasn't been thought, the greatest idea hasn't been ideaed or something like that. It's a little verse.
Yeah, it's a...
And it never ends, really.
It's an evolutionary process, and you must keep at it forever.
What's our next chapter? We have on 13, rescue.
Yes, this was...
Are you implying that we might get lost?
Yes, indeed. Canada spends about $20 million a year looking for people lost in the wood by flying. And so it gets to be a terrible thing. This was early in life. An Indian friend of mine and I were going on a canoe trip, and we were going to be gone for practically 2 months. And we came into a little stop on the Canadian National Railway, and there were four people there. There were two couples, about 40, 45 years of age, and they're very much distressed, and they were very well dressed, and they looked as though they were very affluent and so forth. Their boys, their two sons, had gone on a canoe trip, and the time that they were supposed to return, they didn't show up, and weeks had gone by. So there was a provincial policeman there, or a Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman, I can't remember which now, standing there talking to them, and they were planning to hire some Indians and so forth to go up into that area to find them, and then the police were going to also go up. And at that time, of course, we didn't have airplanes to fly around and look for them. And we came in there, and when these people found out that we were going up into that wilderness on a canoe trip, they were very distressed to think that we were going to get lost too, you know. So the Hudson Bay man there, the man at the store, I don't remember, it was a Hudson Bay store or a private store, a one-man operation. He said, well, these two fellows were on a dog sled trip, he said, for 300 miles in this country. He says, in the wintertime, I don't think they're going to suffer any. So they asked if we would look for them. And we were pretty poor, both of us, the Indian and I at that time. And these people loaded us down with money, told us to spend any amount of money we could with the Indians to have them look for it up in that country. So this is a very rather sensational rescue of these two young fellows. And I think that it almost has the element of a story of fiction rather than truth. And every word of it is true. And I think that whoever gets a hold of a book, either in the library or buys a copy of it, will enjoy the succeeding chapters, which are really great adventures. And this rescue is one that I think everybody will enjoy reading.
Well, you've given me an indication that the two were found.
They were found. Okay. One of them, we found them. One had broken his leg. And they were getting, at that point, where soon I think both of them would have perished. We caught them just in the nick of time.
Well, we come to chapter 14, and this is titled A Tragic Interlude.
Well, this is another story, and it's a story of where I went on a dog sled trip with the police to bring out a body. The Indians had reported this trapper found dead in his cabin, and we were in no hurry to get up there because the body was frozen solid, and the Indians had carefully closed the door so that there wouldn't be any animals getting in there gnawing on the body. We got up there, and I had been in the medical corps of the Navy for 2 years, so I had a pretty good knowledge, elementary knowledge, of certain symptoms of illness. And when we got up there, we discovered that the man had died of smallpox. And this put us in a very precarious position, and it just tells the story of what happened.
Now, the remainder of the book then, we have the sourdough legend on chapter 16. Is this one that is another true story?
This is not a true story about a legend.
This is
the story of the sourdough pail, the use of sourdough, and it not only is a recipe of how to the best to handle the sourdough pail, but it tells the story of how it started, and it's absolutely essential need in traveling in the wilderness. Many people go in the wilderness living on baking powder, bannock, and so forth, and they get sick. And this is one of the great stories of the time, and it's coming right up to the present day, because on the West Coast, there's a bakery there that's putting out 75,000 loaves of sourdough bread a day, and they're expanding all over the country. And if anybody wants to really know how to handle a sourdough pail and know the story way back to the mining element in Alaska in the early days, why they should read this chapter, because I think they'll enjoy it. It's a kind of an adventure in a way too, you see.
Chapter 17, what do we have here?
Well, we have the wilderness indigene, which is kind of an unusual word. It means indigenous with a particular area or having lived in a certain area till you get your roots into that particular area, into the ground. And so in this chapter, I'm trying to show how people become almost addicted to an area, and they think they can't move away from it and get away from it or get into another environment, but it does tell what happens to people who actually get away from it, and people who actually live in a certain area for a long time or throughout their lives.
How many pages do we have altogether in this particular book? It's a pretty good sized one.
Yeah, it's a little more. There's 241 pages.
More than that. Well, in chapter 18, Cal, you've written as the title of this chapter, Our Place in Nature. I would assume here you're speaking of everyone, our place, right?
Well, this chapter is touching on a pretty sensitive subject. Most people want to detach themselves from the mammalian species of the world, and so I have come to this conclusion after over a half century of living in the woods, that we are just one more creature on this earth, and that when we start destroying other creatures in order to maintain ourselves to the greatest advantage, we are breaking up that ecological chain and getting into trouble, and we know we're getting into trouble now. But the point of it is, people want to know what their place is in nature. Well, the fact of the matter is, if they perish out in the wilderness, the elements take care of them just the same as they take care of any other animal. and the point of it is, we don't want to think this. We want to think that, for example, probably less than 100 years ago, all the people who were on this earth were not here.
That's right.
And 100 years from now, or even less, all the 3 billion people that are on the face of the earth today will not be here. They'll be gone. There'll be an entirely new element coming up. But they're coming out of the earth. You know what I mean? They're coming from the elements. The human body is about 5% solids and about 95% water. And that 5% solid, that 95% water, is emanating from the earth. It's coming out of the ground. This ground on which we trample and this ground on which we pollute and so forth, it's from that earth that this next 3 billion or 5 billion or what people are going to come from.
This is
the ground.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
The things we eat.
The thing about it. In other words, we're so integrally a part of the earth itself that, for example, the Indian buried, figuratively, he puts his dead on a scaffold. He puts his up there so that they will evaporate into the atmosphere, and so that all of the elements of the body will gradually disintegrate and become a part of the earth's surface. And so he gets this feeling about it. We bury ours 6 feet under the ground, and we cremate them and so forth and so on. Maybe we should just let them disappear into the wilderness and let them fall into the elements. Now, every one of those molecules and every one of those atoms that's connected with that human body is still alive. See? So if you want to think of it in terms of immortality,
That's immortality.
Maybe there's an atom sitting there on the limb that's going to be there for a long time. And the next 3 billion people are coming from the earth are going to come from the elements. The rotting fence post that's on the fence there that's going down into the earth is becoming an element that may sooner or later become a part of a human being. You know, this is hard for people to understand. They think they're just emanating from some magical position, but they are just coming out of the earth. It's hard to think of all these 3 billion people that are going to live 100 years from now are down in the elements of the earth now.
Just waiting to get here.
Yeah, that's right.
How many people, what you're saying is very easy for me to understand, but how many people look at it as you've just described it?
Very few. Of course, it gets to be a religious proposition. We won't get into religion because everybody has a right to their own.
Charles Lindbergh was one recently that passed away, and he had a very simple ceremony. I think, in fact, he insisted upon a wooden box, nothing more.
Yeah.
Well, Cal, the book is entitled The Wilderness Life by Calvin Rustrum. And, you know, before we leave on today's program, we have an extended program here today, but I want you to admit something to me that I think you readily will because of the dedication in the book. Your strong arm, the person that helps you through these books, your wife. And
indeed.
If you would you read this dedication for me?
Yes, I surely will. This is the dedication that I usually put in all of my books, and I think most of my books have some dedication, and it's to my wife. Way of the Wilderness. Wait a minute.
These
are books by Calvin Rustrum. I'm getting into the wrong. All right.
There we go.
Now, here we go again. I say, Robert Louis Stevenson proclaimed that the secret of writing might well depend on having a good amanuensis. On that premise, I dedicate this volume to Florence, who labored diligently with these pages while also being my wife and wilderness companion. Now, you mentioned this word amanuensis to people, and a lot of people aren't familiar with the term, but it means the person who edits and types and helps you build up your own manuscript. And the fellow says, you got to be careful what you call your wife. I call her an amanuensis. And she has definitely had a very important part in this. For instance, I'm now writing by hand because it seems just as easy to write by hand as it to carry on my terrible typing. I rough out a chapter, and then I go to work and take a pencil and I go through it, and I'll add a modifier here or move a sentence around here or do a lot of things to it. And then my wife will retype it, and she will do some editing on it. You know, if she sees that there's a bad modifier here and a bad modifier there, she'll say, well, is this exactly what you mean? And then she'll call it to my attention. So now it gets worked over again. And so it's a gnawing away of the final manuscript that produces the product that we send to the publisher. And it usually gets worked over about 5 times, and she has to retype this about 5 different times. And I sometimes think that she does more for this book than I do for myself, although I have to create it in the first place.
Cal, we'd like to thank you for coming in and visiting with us today on our public forum program. It's always a pleasure having you around. The wheel's starting to turn on another book, I might ask.
Yes, we just noted today that we had 223 pages of a 300-page book called Chips from a Wilderness Log. It's just a kind of a rehash of the ideas that I've had over the years. Small. Some are just paragraphs, some are just sentences, some are 4 or 5 pages of interesting narrative, and it has a kind of a reference thing too. So that, for instance, if you find just a single page on a certain subject, you might be able to refer to one of my other books and get it expanded in greater detail. And so the publisher is quite excited over it, and he calls me up about every week and asks me how I'm coming.
How are you doing? Well, folks, I would heartily suggest that if you're planning, contemplating taking any of the wilderness, taking it in, that you do read The Wilderness Life, which is the latest, just out, by Cal Rustrum. Way of the Wilderness, The New Way of the Wilderness, The Wilderness Cabin. If you're going to build a cabin, folks, this is a must, this particular book.
This is getting
is
to be...
Is still available?
It's getting to be. In fact, last year they sold 60,000 copies of
Beautiful.
It.
Beautiful.
And that people are beginning to see that wilderness cabin as a way of life now.
Well, the wilderness cabin, this tells you all about how to go about building one.
How to build it and how to live in it, actually.
Right. You do it from log or... Well, read the book. It tells you everything. I remember our talking about Paradise Below Zero. How's this one doing?
That is doing very well. And in fact, it came out in the paperback now, which pleases me very much, and it gets to people who ordinarily couldn't buy the book before. This is a question of traveling viably through the Canadian or the Alaskan or any other wilderness where you've got sub-zero temperatures and you can live comfortably there and still travel. The snowmobile, of course, is kind of pointing up this thing, but too many people are just using snowmobiles for a kind of a reckless adventure, you know.
Well, I have my own feelings on the snowmobile.
Yeah.
I think they're probably one of the greatest aids that's ever been thought of for way out where they're required.
If they will use them as a means of traveling in the wilderness, and then when they get there, shut off that terribly noisy motor, then they can begin to enjoy it. But it is definitely encouraging people to get into the wilderness in the wintertime, and this has of course a great advantage over the whole problem.
Well, thanks again, Cal, for coming in and visiting with us.
I've enjoyed it. Maybe we can get together on the next one.
Won't be too long, right?
Oh, yeah, it takes about a year.
You'll still be about a year.
It takes about a year.
Well, certainly be looking for your visit next time, Cal Rudstrom, and the book we've been discussing today. We didn't get through the last two or three chapters there, but it's The Wilderness Life, and it's available now, and as Cal said, it's available in bookstores and even in libraries, so folks get it, and thank you, Cal.
Thank you.